Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 335, recorded Friday, February 23rd, 2018. Andrew Keen, How to Fix the Future. Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you could be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. And by ZipRecruiter. Looking for your next great hire? ZipRecruiter offers simple tools and powerful matching technology to find you qualified candidates efficiently and effectively. It's the smartest way to hire. Try it free at ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting... Yes, I'm back. I'm here. I only get to do this once a month now, but I get to pick my authors, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology. My guest today is, it's not his first time in the Triangulation hot seat. He's a dear friend I've known for some time, and he keeps writing provocative books. You may remember The Cult of the Amateur, but that was 2007.
Yeah, a long time ago.
And then the last book you were here for, which is The Internet is Not the Answer, the world's most famous Luddite, who is no longer a Luddite. I'm happy to say Andrew Keen is.
I was never a Luddite. You knew that.
Yeah, I knew that. You say in this book, your new book, How to Fix the Future, you've pivoted.
Yeah, well, that was a joke.
I know it was. Silicon Valley pivot. No longer anti-technology. Were you not? Okay, so be better before we get into this. Why are you not a Luddite?
Look, a Luddite smashes machines.
Okay.
Right?
You're not Ned Ludd.
Luddites thought that we go back to candles and caves, and even I wasn't that extreme. I mean, a lot of people call me an internet skeptic.
Yeah, well, that's fair.
Well, I think I was a realist. You know, yeah. Back in 2007, I wrote Cult of the Amateur, which you and I argued about for years, saying that this fetishization, to use an interesting word, of doing away with gatekeepers, experts, curators like you, wasn't overall good for media. It was bad in two ways. Firstly, it undermined professionalism, made it harder and harder for professional journalists and entertainers to make an income. And secondly, it opened the door to corruption, to trollery. And, you know where we
are. Are you taking a victory lap now, 10 years later?
I'm not taking a victory lap. Someone asked me, how do you feel about this? Do you feel really vindicated? And I thought about it, and then I thought, actually, I feel relieved, because I wasn't actually sure I was right. I mean, you always
guess. You couldn't
have
been more accurate, as it turns out.
Well, I took an extreme view, which certainly wasn't wrong.
You're a little bit of an agent provocateur. I mean, you're not...
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't entirely right.
You wanted to be a little provocative.
No one's ever right.
Right.
But look, you remember back then, there were two big books. There was mine and Chris Anderson's Long Tail. And I don't see Chris Anderson here. Do you? What happened to him?
I don't know. The Long Tail was kind of the opposite view, which was...
He's in the Long Tail.
Yes, he's in the very end, the tip of the... No, that was something that I celebrated, the idea that all of this democratization of new media would give... open many doors for many people, that there was an opportunity, even if you weren't one of the big ones, to survive.
And were you wrong, Leo?
Well, I think in a way this is a representation of what the long tail is. This is a long tail twit.
This isn't long, long tail. This operation. Is a professional journalist, Leo Laporte.
I pretend I'm not.
Well, but you are. You were trained on television. Yeah. You're really good, and you have a great following. And okay, you use really interesting interactive technology, but we're in a studio. We're not in your basement. You're not in your underpants, unless... You're in your purple.
I am in my underpants. I happen to wear something over them, though, unlike many others.
And the reality is that you, again, coming back to the Catholic theme, there are no miracles here.
Yeah. It is a disappointment. I mean, we really did think that the internet was going to be a democratizing force. And it has been. But it's also opened us up to all sorts of trollery, as you said.
And what I would say is that I think what you've done is good in the sense that you don't have some...
I don't have a big corporation.
Yeah, you don't have some NBC guy telling you what you can and can't say. You've built a real business here.
Right.
But it is still a traditional media business. You're a curator. You know, you don't just have someone off the street come in and present your show.
It's what, I'm trying to remember who said this. It was a great phrase. And it was somebody I was reading the other day called industrial media. From the industrial era.
Mm.
And you even talk about the industrial era. Let's talk about this because this is the new book, and I don't want to live in the past. I want to live in the broken future. How to Fix the Future is the new book, just came out. And I think it is exciting because it does, say, well, let's move forward. And the only thing that can fix the future is humans.
Right.
You bring up very early on that the industrial era, and some of the same things that are happening in the technological era happened in the industrial era. So let's talk about history a little bit. What were the problems of the industrial era?
Well, the problems of the industrial era are in many ways relatively similar to what's going on now. You had massive disruption. Everything that people took for granted had been undermined.
Yeah, the Luddites were not against information technology.
And the Luddites were
actually... They didn't want Jacquard looms.
Yeah, I mean, they were hand workers who went around smashing the machines because they thought the machines were taking away their jobs, and they were.
Right.
And the Luddites were followers of a guy called Ned Ludd in Northern English movements.
Who may be apocryphal, but...
Yeah, but this was a real movement
in
historical terms. It wasn't some fantasy.
Right.
So there was massive disruption, huge disturbance. Everything that we took for granted, or everything that was taken for granted about the industrial age, was undermined.
Right.
You had the appearance of an incredibly wealthy, powerful new class of industrialists, and this massive working class or underclass of people who were poorly paid and lived in poverty, what Marx called the proletariat. You had a crisis, a perceived and a real crisis of jobs. It was harder and harder to get work on the land, so people came to the town, the city, the factory. Some people got jobs in factories, but many didn't. You had a kind of cultural crisis where more and more sort of people were angrier, more and more sort of corrosiveness about public discourse, and many societies teetered on revolution of one kind or another. The reactionaries of sort of nationalism and xenophobia, which ultimately resulted in fascism, and then the leftist revolutionaries that resulted in communism. Both fascism and communism, of course, in the European context, were catastrophes, led to war and enormous misery, and failure of models. Both models were failures. So I think in those three areas, there's a lot of similarities. What you didn't have, which is interesting, comparing the industrial and the digital age, and I think the digital revolution is also as profound, as disruptive, as undermining everything we've taken for granted. I mean, you know, you cover this every week on your show. But the one difference, I think, is that the business model of capitalism, of profit, of selling products, was viable in the long term. What I've argued over the last 10 years and what I suggest in the book is that what I call the surveillance capitalist model of many Silicon Valley companies, not all, but many, particularly Google and Facebook, isn't viable in the long term because everybody's been turned into products. And we have a big data economy, which I think in the long term is profoundly flawed. So history doesn't always repeat itself.
It's not a perfect repetition.
Yeah, one of the people I interview in my book is Brad Burnham, one of the partners at Union Square Ventures, and he quotes Mark Twain, who says history rhymes.
Yeah, that's a better way.
And so the themes, but it's important. I mean, you'll have people on your show who will tell you, this has never happened before. We've never had AI. We've never had virtual reality. We've never had the internet. This is the first time in human history, and that tends to be a sentiment in Silicon Valley. Partly, I think, because people are so ignorant of the past. There's a kind of cultural amnesia. And partly because they think that because the technology is different, then everything is different. But actually, the technology is less interesting, I think, than the socioeconomic consequences and disruption associated with that.
You point out that the savior of human society in the Industrial Revolution was humans. You talk about the maybe way, the yes, right. No, maybe way.
Well, I think the important thing, and this is particularly important, I think, in the digital age, we've invented technology that in many ways replaces us, especially AI. is creating algorithms and robots and all sorts of other applications that do most of what we did. So the great question becomes, of the 21st century in very broad terms is what are humans good for? What are we going to do in an age where we've created machines that replicate us? The one thing that computers can't do, Ada Lovelace, the inventor of software, 19th century inventor of software, the daughter of Lord Byron, one of the most romantic and brilliant people in the history of computers. She was the business partner of Charles Babbage, who invented the physical, the analog computer, the mechanical computer. She said it very clearly. I quote her in the book, that computers don't have goals. They can't have agency. And I think that's what we need to concentrate on. So I invent, you know what Moore's Law is, Gordon Moore, Intel's co-founder, explain the engine of the digital revolution about the doubling of processing power every 18 months. I invent a different kind of Moore's Law, Thomas Moore's Law, M-O-R-E.
I thought it was a misspelling.
A misspelling in the book. But the first chapter of the book is called Moore's Law. And it's what Moore in Utopia, which is another very good book, by the way. If you read my book, read Utopia afterwards. Better than mine, of course. I don't think mine will be around in 500 years. But Moore suggested that and Moore's Utopia actually is not a utopian book. But what Moore was reminding us is what makes us human is our ability to shape our future, right, to make our future. In times of disruption, when he was writing, it was equally disruptive, if not more so. He was reminding people that they have a responsibility to make their future. And that's what I'm saying in the book. And we have five tools. We've always had the same tools as human beings, whatever technologies comes along, whether it's industrial or digital. We have the tool of regulation, the tool of innovation, the tool of consumer power, the tool of citizen engagement, and the tool of education. So everything has changed, but everything has stayed the same.
We'll be back. I love having Andrew on. Love debating.
I love
and
being on
arguing with you.
My book.
It's always
I don't
fun.
Know if anyone, do any of you, does anyone buy this book?
Does anybody buy books, Andrew?
I
you should tell
do.
Me. You're the book author.
Some people do.
I stopped writing them years ago.
Yeah, well, you have a real job. I don't have a real job.
No, it is the last bastion of intellectualism and thoughtfulness because, you know, a blog post of 500 words.
Yeah, 70,000 words in there and a lot of travel and you can't
100 you interviewed 100 people for this.
More than 100. I mean, 100 are in the book. I think it's probably about 150. Some of them didn't get in the book.
This is called How to Fix the Future. It's Andrew looking on the bright side. You talk about there's kind of the idealists, and in tech we have them, the Mark Andreessens of the world. Say, don't worry about a thing because everybody's going to have a universal income and everything will get so cheap that there will be no more poverty. There's the realists or the fatalists who say everything, it's crap, we're the Ned Luddites, it's over. And then there's the maybes, you call them, the people in between, the humanists.
Yeah.
And that's what this book is for people who say, no, you know, technology's not going to solve everything, but nor is it going to break everything.
And I think that's most of us. I mean,
I think it's the normal person.
There are very few. Yeah. I wouldn't even put Andreessen in that category. I think he even recognizes that it's not just going to naturally work itself out.
We have to
out.
Do something. Yeah.
Right. And I don't know. I mean, really, are there Luddites, people who want to smash machines, who wants to close Apple or
no,
Google?
No, but I'm rapidly becoming one.
Oh, you are?
Because, as often happens, I was an idealist who thought that back in 2007, when you wrote The Cult of the Amateur, that the fall of the gatekeepers, the democratization
Web 2.0,
which would change everything for the better. And now here we are sitting with Twitter and Facebook and fake news. And like most idealists who fall off the wagon, I was thinking about depressed.
This. And I think what happened was that we just took it for granted, and I would include myself in this, that we assume that most people were honest. And the whole premise of Web 2.0 is that people were honest and they wanted to contribute to making the world a better place. And I think that was captured in something like Wikipedia. I've been critical of Wikipedia, but in many ways, Wikipedia has done a good job.
It's a shining example.
Yeah, I mean, of smart, responsible people who got together and unselfishly contributed to making the world a better
place. And I think, by the way, that's the vast majority. That's like 99%.
But what we forgot is that if you have well-financed, dishonest machine like the troll factories in Moscow, you can just do enormous damage.
We've really opened our... But it, in a way, it's the nature of this country that we choose openness. And this, it's... I mean, I think going back to our founding, that we generally tend toward openness to ideas. You could bring up a lot of counterexamples, but I think in general, we celebrate individualism, we celebrate freedom, but there's a downside of that, which is there are those out there who would take advantage of it.
Mm. But I think with the recent...
And we've given them tools. This is the real problem. We've given them a tool that they've been able to weaponize, and that's the real problem.
And when you get a country like Russia that is just sort of institutionally organized around cheating...
Right.
And they can use this open tool to really corrupt the media and do huge damage.
You've given them a megaphone.
Right. Huge damage to our democracy, to our ideals. So it's something that I think that at some point it's going to become increasingly clear that these companies are and I've been making this argument for years, ever
since
Scott
and Amazon. And I have to say,
but these companies are media companies.
Yeah.
And they have to be as accountable as media companies.
They wanted to be platforms. They didn't want to be responsible.
And you can't just open an account on Twitter or Facebook and we have to, and people to say, oh, that's fine, you know, we believe who you are, because half the people are lying.
Well, we know that now.
Right.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to get positive. We're going to talk about what the challenge is, yes, but also that there is a hope and there is something.
Tim O. Well, I've become, you know, Tim O'Reilly was.
He's talking to the chat room now. Tim O'Reilly would be great to have on with you. I think that'd be a lot of fun. Yeah.
You know, I have to say, Tim O'Reilly is one of the, you know, I make jokes about Anderson because I don't think he's a particularly nice fellow, but O'Reilly is the reverse. You know, my first book was very kind of nasty about O'Reilly and the food cam, and it was a bit under the belt, and he wasn't very happy about it, but. After this last book, which he picked up at a conference we were both doing, he sent me an extremely nice email and said, look, we're on the same page. We should have lunch. So we've become friendly.
Good.
So I think someone like O'Reilly actually represents the best side. I mean, he was the guy, of course, invented the term Web 2.0.
Right.
But it does mean there's hope when people like O'Reilly and myself can start agreeing on stuff. Right?
Well, I'm just saying, this is your victory lap. We've all acknowledged. All right. Keane got it right. Let's see what we can do now. Let's take a break. We're going to have more with Andrew Keane and his new book, How to Fix the Future. Our show today brought to you by a company who wanted to fix the past, the mortgage lending business. They're the number one mortgage lender in the country, at least in terms of customer satisfaction, number one for 8 years running, according to J.D. Power. I'm talking about Quicken Loans. They're actually the number two lender in the country after a very big bank, $92 billion in loans last year. But Quicken Loans... Even though they're doing great, they said there's something wrong with the mortgage approval process. It's a little bit stuck in the past, the idea of having to go to a bank, put on a necktie and trousers, go to a bank, fill out a multi-page application, beg and plead with the lender to give you money. And then once they say, well, we'll accept your application, you have to go back and get paperwork. You got to go to the attic or the basement and find a bunch of old stuff like pay stubs and bank statements. You got to be calling financial institutions saying, can you give me my bank statement from the year 2014? Or, I mean, it's just endless. And I say this, maybe I'm a little bitter because we got a loan from that big bank 4 years ago, Lisa and I, when we bought our house. And it took more than a month. We almost lost the house because they kept coming back saying, we want more paperwork. This is the way I'll do it from now on. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. They decided to make a fast, technological, client-focused mortgage approval process completely online. No more going to the bank. The application is remarkably short. It's just stuff you already know like your name, your address, your birthday. You fill out the form. They have trusted relationships with all the financial institutions. So as soon as you give permission, they can get the information they need. They crunch the numbers, and within minutes, they'll come back based to you on the same. You're basically standing there holding the phone waiting. They say, okay, on the page or the website or whatever, it's all on the web. Here are the loans you qualify for based on income, assets, and credits. Credit, you choose the term, you choose the down payment, you choose the rate. They say, good, you're good to go. Big green button, approved. You could literally do it in an open house. I want to, but let's buy this house. Show the, and say, hold on a second. You see, we're approved. Show the realtor, you're good to go. Rocket Mortgage, fast, easy, transparent. It really is the only way. Apply simply, understand fully, and mortgage confidently with Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage to get started. In fact, even if you're not right in the middle of buying or refinancing, by the way, they do refis too, you can go there and set up the account so you'll be ready. RocketMortgage.com/triangulation. It just takes a minute. RocketMortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org. Number 3030. RocketMortgage.com/triangulation. We thank him so much for making triangulation possible. Andrew Keene is here. How to Fix the Future, brand new. Buy it in dead tree format. Buy it on a Kindle. Is there an Audible version of this yet?
I didn't know Kindle was still around. No one reads ebooks anymore.
I was reading
that's really old fashioned.
Last
Leo.
Night.
That's
I know,
the last
it's old
generation.
School, isn't it?
Book is the new bit. The new thing of books. Physical
you know
books.
It's funny. I very frequently will buy books in at least two, maybe three versions. I will buy the audio version.
I like the audio. Audio is great.
Yeah, I love audio.
And it's out in audio, by the way, as well.
That's what I was asking. Yeah, so there is an Audible version. There's not so much this book. I could listen to this book. But like if it's a Russian novel, you got to read the names.
I tell you what, Audible, I really love it when you have the autobiographies read by the famous authors, like the Springsteen one.
Oh, isn't that great?
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Or the Keith Richard one, when he sort of comes in.
Well, it's Johnny Depp playing Keith Richard through three quarters of the novel. And then Johnny goes, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the real Keith Richards. And Keith reads the last chapter. And you realize that Johnny Depp has been doing his impression of Keith Richards. It's fabulous. No, who do you get reading this?
They wouldn't let me do it. They had someone.
You'd be great. Why wouldn't they let you do it?
Because I did my first two. I think they have someone a bit more professional. I'm too much of an amateur for that.
Sex, Drugs, and Moore's Law. I don't know why that jumped out at me.
I don't remember that. What was
it's in here.
Is it?
How to Fix the Future. So we've been I love talking to Andrew because he's smart, he's literate, but he also gives us a much needed, dare I say, anodyne. I like to throw in big words when I have people like Andrew here. Take on technology that we need because I am such a good example of the bad part, which is over-optimistic in the beginning and then overly pessimistic now.
But I think we've got the big danger now is not turning Silicon Valley into the next Wall Street, into the sort of the enemy
of the
people.
You point out more money was paid to Silicon Valley executives in stock options than is paid to Wall Street brokers in bonuses last year.
And Silicon Valley
spent more money.
And they spend more. The big five spend much more money lobbying than big oil or big pharma or big chemicals.
We've had Scott Galloway on here.
Yeah,
his book
good.
On the four says that they better pay attention. Apple, Facebook, Google, and Amazon, because they're about to get heavily regulated. I don't know in this current administration if anybody's going to get regulated. In fact, I think lobbyists are going to win for the next few years. But at some point, I think people are going to say it's happening in the EU.
I have a chapter where I meet Margaret Vestager.
She's great.
She's an amazing woman.
I did not like her, but I'm coming around. Yeah.
So partly I hope through my description of her.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that just as with Microsoft, the first kind of push against Microsoft in the 90s came from Europe, the same is true now. And I think the reality is with Vestager's work on antitrust, with the general data protection laws that are coming out.
GDPR is going to be a very interesting
thing. It's a big deal. And we should have the right as consumers to carry our data around with this. It's certainly not perfect. It will need to be refined. But these are the beginnings. And the Europeans are the most innovative when it comes to regulation. I think it's really important to remember that the best kind of regulation is innovative. And that we're kind of back in the 90s where we've got this four or five companies that dominate everything. It's very hard to do a startup. The only exit is being bought by them. They're squeezing a lot of innovation because they favor their own business models and ecosystems. And, you know, I talked to Brad Burnham. I talked to John Borthwick. I talked to a lot of leading venture capitalists, especially early stage people, and they don't like the situation any more than us.
Some of that, though, is them running for cover because they, like as Scott says, they're going to be gunning for you. So maybe now it'd be prudent.
Yeah, but these guys aren't making any money. I mean, okay, maybe sometimes their companies get sold to Apple.
It's pretty hard though. If you're not going to compete against Google or Amazon. I mean, that's got to be almost impossible at this point.
Yeah, and when you invest in a company, you know the only way you're going to exit is by being acquired by them,
by the biggies.
Right.
So one of the truisms, and I'd like to know if you consider it the case, is that in the United States, generally antitrust regulation is to benefit consumers.
Yeah.
But what Margareta Vestager, I'm going to try to say her name.
Margareta
Vestager.
Danish.
It's hard to pronounce right. But what the EU is trying to do is surprisingly protect companies and their competitive situation. Mm. Presuming that that will ultimately benefit consumers.
Well, they're also, I mean, Vestager's case against Google is that it's not illegal in European or American law
to be a monopoly.
To be a monopolist. What is illegal is if you have a very strong position in one market to use that to favor another market. So the case against Google is mostly built around their travel service, where the Google search engine, Vestager has found, I think she fined them enormously, I think they've kind of acknowledged it, that Google was using it to promote their own services, which is obviously a catastrophe for other online travel services.
It was shopping, and I would agree now that because they bought IAT, it's funny, you would think they'd be chastened by their experience with shopping, but they seem to be doing exactly the same thing with travel.
And it's interesting that, you know, some of the most sort of vocal critics of Google are sort of mid-range, mid-sized American tech companies like Yelp. I mean, Yelp's financing some of this stuff in Europe. They're financing some of the organizations that are going after Google. So it's not just small guys. It's not just people who are opposed to technology. Is that your Google lawyer?
It's pretty. It's the lawyers from Google saying, you better shut up. Get this guy off.
Actually, I found, to be fair to Google, I found them way more open company than some of the other large ones.
Well, you know, we were talking about this
very
on Wednesday
tolerant in
with Kevin Toefel, who used to be at GigaOm and worked for Google for a while, who said, without exception, everybody he met at Google was pro-consumer, pro-people. They wanted to do the right thing. But I think it's also the case that a corporation can be made up of people with those motivations, but not act as if that, because they're driven by revenue.
I'll tell you one thing that's really interesting on the antitrust front is, as you say, antitrust law is built around the interests of the consumer.
In the U.S.,
but in the U.S., but also I think in Europe. But I think there's more and more calls. The Economist wrote some interesting stuff about this, where we need to rethink the very idea of antitrust in terms of consumers, particularly in terms of Amazon. Because the real giant on the horizon, not really on the horizon, right in front
They're
of
here.
Us, is Amazon.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone is bullish on Amazon. I interviewed Martin Sorrell, the head of WPP and the largest advertising company in the world. He predicts in 2018 that the sort of Google-Facebook duopoly will be replaced by what's the equivalent of, not a triopoly, a trinity of dominant advertising companies.
It's surprising because 85%, you say in the book, of all advertising revenue, online advertising revenue, now goes through Facebook and Google.
And Amazon's kind of joining them.
And one doesn't think of Amazon as an advertising entity.
But it's within their own sort of walled garden. But right. I think that we, you know, Amazon clearly benefits consumers in the sense that we all get great services from Amazon. And it's,
well, this is the problem. Same thing with Google, frankly. And I think more than a few people would argue that Facebook is a boon to them, staying in touch with friends and family. This is why it's difficult to do something about this, because to prove consumer harm is tough in the minds of a lot of people, because they say, but what's the harm? I'm saving money. They've eliminated friction in purchases. Mm. Everything Amazon does is good. Same thing with neutrality.
But I think Bezos
is
a genius on every front. And I think one of the things he's done brilliantly is sort of architect his company in a way that has avoided any antitrust investigations.
Yeah, interesting.
He's learned. I mean, he's up in Seattle. He obviously learned from the Microsoft case. Because
right.
let's face it, had there not been antitrust case against Microsoft, Web 2.0 never would have happened. Microsoft would have turned the internet into an extension of Microsoft.
Right.
They would have. Google. They would have created their own search engine. You know, search would have become just another sort of form of Microsoft dominance.
I mean, AOL's tried to do the same thing. And at this point, Facebook's trying to create.
Mm.
The internet, you know, remake the internet in their image. What about the argument, though? And I think Charles Duhigg referred to this in Sunday's Times piece about the case against Google, that technology companies are not like old industrial models, that they rise and fall because they're disintermediated by innovation. So that ultimately Google will not continue. It's to think that Google will continue is foolish as thinking that, you know, Standard Oil or AT&T.
Yeah, I'm ambivalent about that. But there seems little evidence of that. I mean, Google.
You think that there's no way Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple will ever be bested by somebody, some upstart?
No, of course they will. But I think, firstly, these people have learned. I think one of the things that defines the leadership of all those companies, they're all run by brilliant people, is they understand how vulnerable they are. They understand. Right. Who's that Harvard professor, you know, the one with the law? Christensen. You know, Clayton Christensen's arguments about
the innovator's dilemma.
The innovator's dilemma. They've all read that. They understand that their dilemma is staying ahead of the curve. They all understand, as I think Zuckerberg understands this better than anyone.
Look what he's done. Anytime there's an upstart, he buys them.
Not only buy them, but continually sort of destroying their own business
and
model.
He couldn't buy Snapchat. So
they're all trying to turn their companies into AI companies and virtual reality companies. I mean, the internet itself, as I argue in the book, I mean, is kind of an archaic term now. It's meaningless.
Do these companies get to the point they're so big that they can't fail? Is that what's going on? Or that they can defend their position eternally?
Well, I think in 50 years, the strength of these companies is that they tend to be run by their founders.
Right.
Although, you know, Microsoft seems to be running quite well, and it's run by people.
It's very different than Bill Gates' Microsoft.
But it's much more of a sort of traditional corporate firm. But it's hard to imagine Amazon being as remarkable a company post-Bezos.
Absolutely.
Just as Apple. I mean, Apple's successful, but it's still, Apple is not a jobs company anymore.
So isn't that the argument then, that we don't have to worry about them because ultimately their founders will retire and the company will be replaced?
Well, you could have said the same thing about the banks and the oil companies of the late 19th century. I think that they sort of, you know, taking your word, was it triangulate? Maybe they strangulate the economy.
and they were broken up by government.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they need to be formally broken up. I'm not, you know, there's a lot of gray area between leaving them alone and formally breaking them up. But I think the American... DC is, as you know this better than I do, we were talking about this earlier, DC is broken.
Ironically, if there's any threat, I don't think there's any threat larger to Jeff Bezos than the president. He doesn't like Jeff Bezos for other reasons, but he's gone after Amazon quite a bit. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see if we do see any trust.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff Bezos is one of, you know, as I say in the book, it's hard to determine whether he's the problem or the solution. He's both. Yeah. I mean, he's a remarkable
man. That's what's
man.
Difficult about this. And that's why... So You recommend, we're going to take a break and we'll talk about this, the more difficult path. You say that this is the natural path, the maybe path, but it's also the more difficult. It's easy for people either to say technology will take care of it, it's going to triumph. It's easy for people to say, it's all over. It's hard to say, well, it's gray and we've got to fix it. And let's talk about what we can do.
It's agency, though. We can talk about it, but it's about... You know, the problem, the people who just sit back and say, well, there's nothing we can do about it.
I mean, on the one hand, technological innovation, the revolution, AI, it's all inevitable.
You're not allowed to use that word, Leo, inevitable. Can you cut that word from the show, please?
Is that a
Leo
dirty
is
word?
Not allowed to use inevitable.
But
nothing's
it is,
inevitable,
isn't it?
Leo.
Nothing's
nothing
inevitable.
Nothing is inevitable, and that's the point of the book.
Let's take a break.
Because if it is, I don't need to be here.
It's inevitable, Andrew. You can't stop it. It's an oncoming train.
But even trains have brakes.
Let's take a break. Andrew Keen is here. His new book, How to Fix the Future, is a well-researched prescription for things that we as humans can do to make sure that the future is positive for humans. And that doesn't mean negative for technology. There is a middle way, and I want to find out what it is because I'm desperate for it. But first, a word. It's very interesting because all of our sponsors, Andrew, every one of them, is about disintermediating the old way of doing things, about technological innovation. In the case of our sponsor for this segment, ZipRecruiter, perfect example. ZipRecruiter replaces headhunters, replaces the old employment office, is a better way to find people you need. First of all, I think it's safe to say, you know, if you've got an opening, there's somebody out there that's perfect. But how do you reach them? How do you get to them? We've always mentioned that posting once on ZipRecruiter posts on all the job sites, 100-plus job sites with one click. But even more than that, ZipRecruiter actively, they built a platform to actively find candidates for you. So in a way, they're like a headhunter too. They learn what you're looking for. ZipRecruiter identifies people with the right experience, then invites them to apply for your job. And this is why 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in less than one day. It's actually amazing. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They spotlight the strongest applications you receive, so you don't have to spend a lot of time going through a bunch of applications. You can see immediately what's strong. You never miss a match. Look, the right candidates are out there. Look at the big companies that use ZipRecruiter. 1 million companies have already used ZipRecruiter, including some of the biggest companies in the world. Why not try it for free right now at ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation? The right person for that opening is there. Here's how you find them. In any industry, anywhere in the country, ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. Businesses of all sizes use and trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. We have big companies too, Fortune 100 companies. Right now, you can try it absolutely free. There's no reason not to. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation for your free trial. ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. By the way, they're doing great because technology really does support this kind of thing. And on the one hand, I think we should reward people like Jeff Bezos and Larry Page. These are the Henry Fords of our era. Henry Ford's a bad
example.
Exactly.
You brought up Henry Ford. So, and then you realize.
You could be a business genius, a technological genius.
But look, I'm not so sure about Page because I think Page, and I don't mean this critically, he's a geek. But Bezos is a mensch. He's a grown-up.
Yeah.
He's an incredibly articulate, smart, responsible guy.
And he's played the game perfectly.
And as I argue in the book, I think, you know, I'm ambivalent about Amazon. I've been very critical of Amazon in the past. It's certainly not an ideal company, although it's a remarkable company. But I think someone like him has to step forward now and begin to fix some of the stuff he's broken. So, for example, with joblessness, Amazon is doing more than any other company, I think, in terms of automation and AI.
They're about to open these Amazon Go stores, more of these Amazon Go stores.
But he's the richest man in the world. Yeah. He has, you know, ridiculous amounts of money. Rather than putting his money into launching rockets into outer space. We're not quite sure what the benefit of that is. He should be trying to figure out the long-term consequences of AI and figure out, what are we going to do? Are we going to use guaranteed minimum income? Are there other forms of some sort of social security net or system that will make sure that we don't degenerate into kind of a society of starving people who have no means of support, no opportunity to get work?
In the long run, he has to, otherwise he has no customers.
Right, but he's right, and that's the Henry Ford analogy with the famous remark. I think he was walking around one of his factories with one of the unionists, and he was talking about, you know, cutting the wages of the workers. And he said, and the unionist said, well, if you cut the wages of the workers, they're not going to be able to afford your cars. Right. Not even going to be able to afford, you know, Amazon prices, because it's not like Google and Facebook. He has a real business model. He's actually getting people to pay for stuff, which I admire. I certainly prefer the Amazon model to the Google Facebook model. He is not a peddler of surveillance capitalism.
Except that I bet there's money to be made. He may take advantage of that as well.
But he doesn't need to fall back on it, just as Tim Cook doesn't need to fall back on it,
right.
Just as Microsoft
doesn't. They've got a business
model,
yeah.
I still think that in the long term, their model, their companies are better long-term bets.
Give me some hopeful news.
The hopeful news is there's a lot of amazing stuff going on. I spent a chapter in Estonia. They're trying to sort of rebuild the social contract between individuals and government. Soviet satellite state, full of techies. It's like a big version of Leo's show. I mean, everyone is.
I love Estonia.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you've had some people on.
I've been there, and they had the digital citizen card.
So they got the digital citizen's card. They have a very transparent, digitally run government. But they're also, I think, confronting this issue of anonymity. I saw someone posted on anonymity saying that's the problem. And that's the problem with user-generated content. When people can be anonymous, they lie. They disrespect people. They insult women. They insult minorities. They claim to be one person when
they're
not.
It's a sine qua non of trolling that you have to be anonymous.
So I think what...
although there are some public trolls like Yiannopoulos, Milo Yiannopoulos.
Yeah.
Who's a pub... Everybody knows who he was.
I just got an email from him, actually.
Did you?
I have to admit, I know him. He's not as bad as he seems, although
be very careful there, Andrew, because...
He's still pretty bad. But I mean,
you could be tarred with that brush if you're not careful.
Yeah, and I'm certainly... You know, Milo used to... He was an admirer of my... earlier work. Yeah. So anyway,
I always got the feeling that everything he said was cynical and calculated.
Yeah,
that wasn't genuine.
But coming back to Estonia, what I think the Estonians are, he's the ultimate troll. What Estonians are trying to pioneer.
So he's the counterexample to the anonymity.
Right. I mean, at least he's accountable for what he says. Even what he says is so appalling. But anyway, coming back to Estonia, I think what they are pioneering, and also Singapore is pioneering. I have a chapter on Singapore. Is a new kind of world where we're no longer anonymous. It's a radically transparent world. And a lot of libertarians will say, well, that's terrible. That's
Singapore's
Orwell.
An authoritarian state. Well, do you want to be...
I'm more ambivalent about. But let's just use the example of Estonia, where there's openness. And the understanding is that, for example, you can't post on Estonian newspapers. You got to use your sort of official account. So you can't have trolls on Estonian newspapers. And the police, of course, can look at your records if you do something wrong. But the interesting thing is it's a social contract of reciprocity. So the Estonian state or the government or the police can't start looking at your records without telling you. So what the Estonians are pioneering is a kind of
equal
transparency. What the Estonians, and I'm ambivalent about this, I'm not convinced it's right, but I talked to their president and he basically says, look, we live in a post-privacy age. In the age of big data with smart cars and smart homes and smart everything else, we can't rely on the privacy of the 19th century. So if you accept that, we need to build a world where we have rights in an increasingly transparent place. So I think that's the most interesting thing that Estonia is doing, and I think they're really pioneering that.
Yeah, you mentioned in here the Marshall and Brandeis article about privacy, which I think to some degree really established our modern notions of privacy.
But it was built around photography.
That was the technology that was ruining things.
It was the Kodak age. It wasn't the age of Instagram and Twitter.
Yeah.
or of you know, of iPhones, where everything was so ubiquitous.
But they argued for privacy, that it was a human right.
Yeah, and I think it is a human right, but in a technological age where it's harder and harder to protect ourselves against privacy, we may need to rethink privacy law. So I think the, you know, the Brandeis rule, the 19th century understanding of privacy, I support, but in the 21st century, I'm just not sure how realistic. So I think what the Estonians are doing are pioneering something different, and Singapore too, in terms of their Smart Nation initiative. Now, I accept the fact that they're not a full democracy, but they're not totalitarian in the way the Chinese are. So the nightmare model of this is, of course, what China's doing.
No privacy in China.
No privacy
face
in China.
Face recognition.
In an authoritarian,
everywhere.
But worse than that, in a totalitarian system where you only get a job or a house if you're politically correct.
Right.
So these are the big issues we're all going to have to confront.
That's the important point to make. You're not prescribing a fix.
But the fix would be
we need to get involved and, well, and talk about it.
What I am saying is that we have to confront these issues. I don't think Americans are even confronting them.
No.
And I think what the Estonians are doing is really interesting. And I also think we need to, you know, identity is such a complex thing. I go to India in the book. And whilst, you know, we privileged types fetishize privacy and protection of our identity, what I found in India is a huge underclass. The poorest people in the country have no identity. They have no way of proving who they are, which means they can't get work. They can't get housing. They can't get health care. So what I find in India is that the ID system there is creating identity to benefit poorer people. So even digital identity is a complex issue.
It's very complex. The Nazis, in fact, created identity cards that were required to work, solved the problem, and created a new one.
Right, exactly. And, you know, this whole issue of online identity is so complicated.
Yeah.
But the Estonians are doing great work, the Indians, the Singapore. And so, you know, I spent – the book is really a travelogue of my experiences around the world, seeing how people are fixing stuff. There is no single fix. There's no app to fix the future. It's not going to get fixed with blockchain. Whatever Don Tapscott says, it's not going to get fixed with blockchain. It's not going to get fixed with virtual reality. It's not going to get fixed with augmented reality. We know the failure of the internet. The future didn't get fixed by the internet. So it's a human fix. It's not technology. I'm not against technology, but we can't just rely on technology.
What about education? How important is that?
I think education is key. I mean, you and I both, our kids went to the same school.
Yeah.
We know how important education is. I think the old industrial system, the top-down system of teaching kids by rote, a sort of disciplined hierarchical system doesn't work. You and I, you know, done lots of things. Our kids, so the same six or seven jobs in our lifetime. Our kids are going to do six or seven jobs at the same time. So we need to teach them to be flexible. I mean, one of the chapters, the education chapter, I have a section from Credo High School just up the road in Ronard Park, a Waldorf school. Which is actually America's largest Waldorf high school. I interview a guy called Chip Romer, who's the lead teacher there. And he describes it really well. What he says is that they're working on building the muscle of agency.
Yes.
It's not what we teach kids. They don't need to learn this stuff off by heart. We know that, you know, maybe the engineers and the lawyers and the doctors and the journalists of the future are going to be people who know how to work with machines. They're not going to have this encyclopedic knowledge that industrial professionals have. But what they're going to be able to do is invent and reinvent themselves, and they need agency. Agency is the key. And I think new education institutions, whether they're Montessori, where the Google boys went, or Waldorf, which is now very fashionable in Silicon Valley, where the Ronard Park experiment, these are really important. And at the university level too. And I go to a place in Singapore which is combining engineering and humanities. My solution is we don't all need to go back and read Machiavelli or Plato or Aristotle, but I do think that would be good for engineers, just as I think humanists or, you know, literary scholars or political science students need to become literate in programming.
Yeah.
Education is key. It's my last chapter. It's the conclusion.
Right.
It's the crescendo in the book.
Yeah.
How to Fix the Future, Andrew Keen, he's back. And it's kind of the trilogy of books actually kind of all go together. The Cult of the Amateur. What was the second one? The Internet is Not the Answer. Both of them setting up the third, How to Fix the Future. And always a good read, even if sometimes, at least with the earlier books, you go, what? What? You can't possibly mean that. I have to say, there was nothing in here that I didn't go, yes,
oh, that's
you're
not
right.
Good. It's not
I know,
offensive
Andrew,
enough.
You got to work
be
on
a
it.
Bit
you
more offensive.
Got to get more offensive.
What did I miss, Leo? How do we fix the future, which I didn't cover?
Well, I think probably it's that I gave up and I was excited to know that there is a future. That's probably, for me, the best news. And of course, the challenge is it's up to us.
Mm.
And I think so as geeks, and I know many of you who listen and watch the show are geeks, it's easy for us to say, it's just, you know.
But what do you make, for example, and I cover this in the book, Tristan Harris's argument that a programmer should sign a Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah, first do no harm.
And so they shouldn't, for example, be designing products, services, apps which are explicitly addictive. Do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, there was the same argument for physicists shouldn't work on atomic weapons, right? And it's a nuanced argument because the physicists who worked on the atom bomb in the United States were trying to defeat Hitler and felt that was, if we didn't, that he would, and that he would best us if we didn't. Now, I don't think you can make the same argument for the weaponization of games. And I think that you're absolutely right. We've talked a lot about that. Another area where I poo-pooed it for a long time, this notion even of internet addiction. But what's happened is that we have gotten so adept at creating apps and games that are highly addictive, that are just dopamine generators. And I despair. I mean, I've myself cut myself off now from. I took Twitter off my phone. I took Facebook off my phone. Took Instagram off my phone.
Mm.
Slowly cutting myself off from these because, see, ultimately, and this is the argument we have all the time about fake news as well. Ultimately, there is no. I don't think they can fix it out there.
Well, I think it's a mix.
I think we need to.
But it comes back to my sort of five pillars. So let's take the example of the food industry, which in the industrial age was terrible. It was poisonous. It was addictive. It was overpriced.
Upton Sinclair.
So you have some regulation. You have entrepreneurs coming along, the people who started Whole Foods. You have consumers demanding better products.
Yep.
You have citizens articulating the importance of food.
And it's not perfect.
Yeah, it's not perfect, and it never will be perfect.
But it's a big improvement.
But that's what needs to happen. The examples, the two industries, which I think are really interesting compared to the digital industries, are the food industry and also the automotive industry.
Same thing you talk about.
Right, in the 50s.
Unsafe at any speed.
In the 50s, American car companies were completely dominant. Mm-hmm. No one had heard of Honda or Volkswagen.
Right. Or seatbelts.
Exactly. So they started being really arrogant. They designed essentially death traps, coffins on wheels.
Yep.
Ralph Nader's book, Unsafe at Any Speed, in 1965 was a sensation. And it fundamentally undermined the American dominance of the car industry. And now we know where we're at. And I fear the same, quite frankly, with Google and Facebook.
No, I think we're at that turning point, though.
I think
this book and many others
are
starting to say.
It's not just this book.
It's time to pay attention.
You know, the Germans are now just because we are winning doesn't mean we will win. We, being Americans,
right.
The Germans are very good at re-engineering stuff that somebody else has created. And they're re-engineering search engines. They're re-engineering social networks, which are friendlier to consumers. So I think we have to acknowledge that.
So on the one hand, I agree. And I think in the West, anyway, it's reasonable to say, programmers, you have to be responsible for the work you create and do no harm. First, do no harm. But I also think we're entering an age where China is about to achieve
China's
dominance.
Another story, yeah. China.
And I don't know if we're going to be in the position to determine this future.
Well, we, you know, I think
the
we
West.
Have, but let's be honest here, Leo. We're always honest, of course, together. But it's not our business to determine Chinese internet policy. It's not our business to say how China should run their internet.
No, we can't.
If it was my business, I would tell China that they should have an open internet, all the rest of it. But it's not our business. And so in a way, I think whilst we don't necessarily celebrate the splinter net, we have to acknowledge it's a reality. Look, in the beginning, idealists like Berners-Lee and God rest his soul, the guy who just died, what's his name? EFF guy.
John Perry Barlow.
And they were good guys. I mean, Perry Barlow was a delightful fellow.
Wonderful.
They were idealists. They thought that there would be one media, that it would be global. And the reality today, as I found in the book, is we're seeing the splinter net. We're seeing the emergence of lots of different internets.
The problem, if you don't build walls between our internet and their internet, we're porous. They're not porous. We're porous. That's what we're seeing with Russia.
Well, that's the fascinating. So I talked to David Kirkpatrick. I'm sure he's been on this show as well. And he said that there are all these rumors now that we worry about the Russians, but the real danger is the Chinese. And the Chinese are amassing a massive kind of database of information about all Americans.
Right.
Have you heard that rumor?
You can presume it's fact. Frankly,
that's information warfare. It's not trolling.
The information's out there. They would be foolish not to be. I don't think Russia's as organized. I don't think Russia's.
Yeah,
interests...
Russia's a joke. It's just a load of thugs.
Yeah,
basically, you know, funding other.
I'm far more worried
funding...
about China.
Yeah,
and not in a militaristic way. By the way, I think that.
Well, China is a nightmare model. I mean, they. It's as if they read Orwell's 1984, and they think, okay, how are we going to use these digital tools to make it happen? You have a kind of a new totalitarian leader there who's using digital to make himself even more powerful. Yeah. So China really is a nightmare. And the terrifying thing is that for many people in the so-called developing world, the Chinese model is compelling because China has been so economically successful. Plus, we're disgracing ourselves with the antics in D.C. and Brexit and the other things that are undermining Western democracy. So if you're an innovator, a developer, a politician in India, perhaps, or Southeast Asia or Africa, and you look at China, you think, wow, maybe this is an option.
Well, and we know that China sees this as an opportunity, that this is their time and this is their opening.
And they're incredibly sophisticated when it comes to digital. Their indigenous companies and products are in many ways better.
There's evidence they're far ahead of us AI, for instance.
In YouTube, well, I mean, in terms of real time and user-generated stuff. So,
but I don't want to see them as the enemy, but they culturally are you know,
well, in terms
different.
Of a system, it is a very disturbing trend. Yeah. If they do indeed create what they want to do, which is a radically transparent country where everything is known about everyone, especially with now facial recognition technology and AI and all the rest of it, then they can create one of the first times in history, a really effective, efficient totalitarian state.
Which panopticon.
You know, which you're right, which I wrote about in Digital Vertigo, which Mao didn't do, which Stalin didn't do, which Hitler didn't do, but technology is allowing them to do this.
That's right. That's right.
So this is a reason to be miserable.
You see, I've come around to your way of thinking.
You're
I don't like
this
new optimistic Andrew Keen. This is...
But that's why I think Singapore is an interesting model. Because I brought up Singapore and you immediately said, well, Singapore's authoritarian. It's not really authoritarian. They're somehow lost in this gray area between democracy and authoritarianism. Yeah. So it's a sort of, it's a technocracy, if you like, an expert government, a government of experts.
Yes.
And Singapore is an amazing country. 50 years ago, it was an incredibly impoverished island without any economy, without any relevance in any post-colonial state. Today, it has the highest standard of living, the best education. So I think we in the West have to acknowledge that the Singapore model is viable. Not the Chinese model, but the Singapore model is viable, which is why I really found going to Singapore and writing about Singapore very interesting and challenging. And actually, my editor was a bit... The first version of the Singapore chapter was actually even more sympathetic to Singapore than the one that actually got into the book, because he said to me, you need to be a little bit more critical about Singapore. It's hard not to be impressed with what they've done. Have you been there?
Yeah. And by the way, you go to China, it's hard not to be impressed there as well.
Mm. infrastructure,
we come
you
from
mean?
This is to me, this is the larger problem of all of this. We come from the Democratic West, and what's happening is democracy is has proven to be problematic. And in fact, we're starting to see anti-democratic forces succeed where democratic forces are helpless. And I mean that with a lower D, obviously, lowercase d. And I feel like these authoritarian regimes, let's hope it's a Singapore model, not a Chinese model, can gain ascendancy because they don't participate in this idealistic notion of democracy.
Yeah, well, the hope in China is that enough people will say this is unacceptable. It's one thing to do a deal with government and accept prosperity in exchange for political loyalty.
If you're coming from feudalism,
it's quite another step forward to allow the government into your bedroom, allow the government into your head. That's not a good deal. No one's going to accept that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. You said we shouldn't be talking about politics, and we are talking about politics because tech is politics.
Ultimately,
it's unavoidable.
Ultimately,
and that's why I think tech's so interesting now, because it's it's the heart of everything.
Well, precisely, and that's what I think both you and I saw coming 20 years ago. This was going to be this would be the playing field on which these important things would be decided.
And this is only the beginning of it. I mean, what happens when we have, you know, fully operational AI systems? What happens when we have virtual reality? Remember Brave New World, where Huxley imagined a place where the masses were on drugs?
Soma.
Well, virtual reality is Soma.
I think we're already well along that road.
Let alone, you know, opiates. So the fear of a sort of a technology-saturated world is not one that's just crept up on us. People 100 years ago recognized
it. We've seen it coming. And somewhat hopelessly. I mean, I don't know what you do about it, to be honest with you.
But again, it comes back, and this is where I think you're being a little powerlessness. The worst word you brought up was inevitable. There's nothing inevitable about this. We could have been sitting here in 1850 and had the same kind of conversation. Oh, the pollution. Oh, the inequality. Oh, the heartlessness. And lots of people said that. Oh, we have to go back to candles and fields.
That's
but
not
we
the
didn't.
Way forward, yeah.
And I think that we have a great opportunity now, but only if we roll up our sleeves.
Yep.
I mean, you're wearing a lot of sleeves there, but I've already rolled mine up.
It's been cold in Petaluma lately.
Oh, cold. I just came from the East Coast. But we all have to.
Yeah, you had summer in the East Coast.
Metaphorically, we need to roll up our sleeves and say we are going to shape this technology to our interests, rather than have our interests, you know, exploited by either the technology or the companies that own it. And we can do it. We've done it in the past. It's a story of humanity. We always invent and reinvent ourselves and build better chapters. That's Moore's Law. Not Gordon Moore's Law, but Thomas Moore's Law. That's just as Gordon Moore's Law is the engine of the digital revolution, Moore's Law is the engine of this book.
Yeah. M-O-R-E. How to Fix the Future. Walter Isaacson said, a bracing book.
I don't know if that's an advertisement.
No, this is awesome. It's really an important read and raises, as you can see, questions as much as it does answers, but important questions that we all have to ask. How to Fix the Future, Andrew Keen. It's always a pleasure having you in.
It's always a pleasure.
I wish we had more time to talk. Thank you.
Well, you give me a lot of time. I appreciate it. Yeah. Thank you for the great questions.
We do Triangulation every Friday. It's not always with me, but Friday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC. If you want to watch live, you're the third leg of this stool, the third side of the triangle. Your questions and thoughts and comments in the chat room are very much appreciated, but you have to watch live to do that at irc.twit.tv and twit.tv/live. Get them both fired up and then get in there and get in the conversation. Thanks, of course, as always, to Jason Howell and Megan Maroney and Father Robert Ballester, who rotate this with me. We've had so many great conversations over the last few weeks and many more to come, so make sure you tune in for next time. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.